This meeting of the House Agriculture Rural Development Finance Committee is called to order. We have a quorum present, and we have before us, before the members, the minutes of our most recent meeting held Thursday, February 19th. The chair entertains, recognizes Representative Otto.
I move the minutes, Ms. Madam Chair.
Representative Otto moves approval of the minutes. Is there any discussion? If not, we'll proceed to vote. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion carried. The minutes are adopted. Today we'll be hearing from the Agricultural Utilization Research Institute and acting on two bills. I do want to call to the members' attention the deadlines that have been set as parameters for processing of bills here in the House. The first deadline is Friday, March 12th, for committees to act on bills originating in the House. The second deadline is Friday, March 19th, and the third deadline to act on omnibus finance bills is March 26th. So those three Fridays, the 12th, 19th, and 26th, are the three deadlines for House committees. We'll now hear from the Agricultural Utilization Research Institute. I'll call the representatives of the organization forward for a report. Members of the committee will remember that we enacted a significant change in the budget for this organization, so I'm certain they'll be talking about the changes that this has meant for them and also bear some good and exciting news as positive news as well. So welcome to the committee, gentlemen.
Well, thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Edgar Olson, Executive Director at AURI, and I'm glad to be here today to give you an update on AURI. As everyone knows, the past several months have been difficult in terms of budgeting and making adjustments. So today we want to talk about the challenges as well as the areas that we see promise and opportunity. Today we want to specifically focus on the areas and three important areas: recent reorganizational activities, organizational focus and areas, the Agricultural Innovation Center grant. I know the committee has had many things on the agenda, so we'll try to move quickly and be able to have you get to your bills that you need to have adopted today and passed out. The operations, the operating environment in the past several months has been challenging, like I mentioned before. The 2003 project activity spending was suspended three times. This created difficulties for AURI staff and clients and slowed project activities. With the future funding uncertain and a 60% reduction, AURI needed to make budgetary and programmatic changes to ensure the viability of going forward. The reorganizational activities in the summer and the fall of 2003, the reorganization, we managed to significantly reduce the budget. A review of programs and services were undertaken, resulting in positions being eliminated, facilities were closed, and space was reduced. The result is a much smaller organization. I feel AURI is capable of helping Minnesota agriculture and producers and processors through our capabilities, though our capabilities were reduced. Our primary objectives in reorganization were to streamline the programs and services, further streamline management functions, and address critical budget restraints, and to ensure the long-term viability of the organization. Focus resources on the efforts with the largest potential commodity impacts, and try to locate other resources that were available to AURI. I'd like to give you a summary of some of the overview of the organization, starting with some of the financial information. The 2003 AURI budget was $5,200,000. That was a budget reduction in that year of $1,288,000. The 2004 budget is $2,800,000. This represents a reduction of $2,100,000. In this end, represents a reduction of overall budget of 53%. Staffing and payroll and salaries, 28 people in the year 2003, was $1,006,000. Staffing in 2004 is 18. which is $957,000. This represents a 36% reduction in staff numbers and a 40% reduction in payroll cost. In facilities, the cost of facilities and rent in 2003 was $249,000. Facilities and cost in 2004 is $166,000. This represents a reduction in facilities rental expenses of 33%. Reorganization and staff reductions in the Crookston office. We eliminated the positions of lab and pilot plant coordinator, the director of technology and client development, application of software and network web specialist, the director of information and technology, and realigned the positions of scientist, microbiology, industrial ag products, and the food scientist areas. In the Morris office was closed. We eliminated the position of program, of a project assistant. In Marshall, we eliminated the position of meat scientist. Waseca, we eliminated the position of project development person, and we left unfilled the engineering services position. The effect as far as in facilities and facility space reductions, we closed the pilot plant in Crookston and reduced office space. This resulted in a change in a reduction in rent of about $48,000. In Marshall, we reduced office space for a reduction of $9,600. In Morris, closing the office resulted in a reduction of $9,600 in rent. The St. Paul office, closing that, there was a reduction in $12,800 in rent. With reduction of the lab space and storage area in the Waseca office was a total of $6,300 for roughly a reduction of just slightly over $86,000 in that particular area. Given all these changes, we have headed to refocus and reprioritize our activities. And at this point, I'd like to turn it over to Max Norris, who will give you an overview of the organization and the priorities that we have established.
Welcome Max. To the committee, Mr. Norris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Max Norris, and I'm Director of Projects and Technology with AURI. This has, as Director Olson said, been a very interesting year. One of the things that I would like to share with the committee is the fact that, you know, AURI over the years has been involved in quite a number of things. We're still involved in quite a number of things, but not at the depth that perhaps that we had in the past. It has been our objective to be very specific of the various projects that we bring into the organization and the areas that we cover. We're looking for, as suggested, looking for opportunities that will bring benefit to agriculture in the state of Minnesota and bring it within a reasonable time period. The other thing that I'd like to share with you is as we talk in terms of the major areas of involvement, I think in your handout that you have an opportunity to peruse, you will note that there are activities that are related to energy. There's activities that are related to commodity improvement as far as value addition and essentially moving to increase the wealth in rural Minnesota. I've always had the opportunity or taken the opportunity to say that what I think a perfect project for an organization like AURI is a project that defines a commodity that is grown in the rural part of Minnesota and is transported to a local site for manufacture in rural Minnesota, and the value that is gotten from those crops accrued to the growers and ranchers around the state and ultimately to the state of Minnesota. And that, I think, is one element in a nutshell that we tried to do during this time of somewhat difficulty. And at times it's been very difficult to do that. The other thing that one has to pay very much attention to in carrying out this type of work is that in most cases you can't do it by yourself. So therefore, as we have done in the past, and continue to do now. We depend very heavily upon a variety of partners across the state. I think Kai will comment on the this in a little more detail. But when you begin to think that there is a business end to every project, so we have partners in the SBDC area. We also deal with a sister group in the state with the Department of Agriculture, and we have great abilities to work with them. We have the universities across the state, whether it is a state university system or whether it is the university. And when we actually get down to the facts, bringing these people into some of these projects, and again, I'm really not telling you anything that we haven't told you on previous discussions. We've kind of always done that. But we have to do it a little more severely today than perhaps when you can cast a very wide net out there and hope that you find a lot of fish. Some of them may be small, some may be medium, some may be large. Now we're looking for the ones that that have the opportunity for impact. Could be a small project, but it could have impact. It could be a medium-sized or a large project, but it needs to have impact. The other thing that I would share with you is that under the priorities that we've established for ourselves as we review opportunities, as we formulate projects that could and should and will come into the organization and be presented to our board, we pretty much narrowed it down, if you will, to energy and co-products. And what comes along with that, keep one thing in mind, I guess, is that we're talking about renewable energies. The state of Minnesota certainly sits in a position of being leaders in energy across the board. But when we look at it, we have opportunities to not only be in ethanol and in biodiesel, but we have opportunities of dealing with other biomasses that happen to be grown within our state, and that we have the opportunity to take those forward and hopefully into successful generation of electricity or whatever the situation might be. Associated with all this stuff, when you begin to work with it, is analytical laboratories. You got to know what you're working with. So we do continue those type of activities there. And we offer project services in this area to aid in the development of the projects and hopefully in bringing them to successful conclusion. We can't forget commodity utilization of food and non-food items that are out there. We've got a variety of products in the marketplace that we've put there in the past with a lot of people's help, and that we can put there in the future. And we still can continue to do limited technical assistance on site. Client comes through the door, we identify that client, and we carry out the necessary work to hopefully make a reality and an impact out of the work. The meats processing and product development area. We've chatted with you folks again about this in the past, and that area continues to go forward. We have a lot of grains being produced within this state, and we need something to eat it, to be very frank with you. So when it comes down to it, whether we're talking about any of the species that are out there, further processing of animal products into useful forms and into maybe sometimes rather non-traditional application are the things that we hope we can bring to the party. The targeting, if you will, of the clients and projects in this manner allows us to continue to assist the small entrepreneur, but in a somewhat different way than we have done in the past. We don't go quite as wide, and we don't go quite as deep, because we can't. The project development priorities are targeted to those areas of producer-owned cooperatives, ag processors. Director Olson has used the comment many times. We tend to be the research arm of the smaller organizations out there that have no R&D, and we try to provide that. We also deal with these broader groups in such a manner that we have impact over a larger number. And I'll make some comments in just a moment about that. Sometimes if we get real small projects in, it may be one or two people. And there may be great impact in that family. Don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying that we should not do that. But we have to be very careful how many of those projects of that nature that we take in. Because with limited resources, one, it takes just as much technical time and effort to do a small project as it does a large project that has impact.
Excuse me. I'm just going to interrupt for a minute, and I want to welcome the ninth grade students from St. Louis Park High School. And you're in the Ag Committee. We're now hearing from ORI. It stands for Agricultural Utilization Research Institute. And they're kind of briefing us on what they're doing and how they withstood the cuts from the past years and so on. So we're glad to have you here, and hopefully you can stay for a while. The next bill up will deal with manure digesters, and we deal with a lot of things in the Ag Committee. So welcome. And if you would continue, Mr. Norris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The area I'd like to chat with you a bit now about is how have we taken some of these items forward over the last year under the environment that each of us had to deal with. Just want to bring your attention to working with the co-products that we deal with from energy-related items, for instance, as an example. Everybody's heard about biodiesel, I'm sure, sitting on this committee. It is a very exciting area that we have, and Minnesota, again, is the leader in carrying that into the national arena. So consequently, we have to deal with some other things. When you make biodiesel, you make co-products. And one of those co-products, which I won't go into the chemistry, this is not the place for it, but it's a product called glycerin. And when we have that material, we have to define uses and applications for it, or we have a product that sits in the marketplace today at 80 cents a pound that will be 20 cents a pound if we don't have uses and application. That opens up opportunities too if the price goes down. But if it goes down too far, certain businesses shall not be there. The same type of situation on co-products falls in the area of ethanol. Well, we don't do a lot of direct work in ethanol as far as building another plant, because that technology, for the most part, is in place. A lot of people know how to do it and are doing it. But again, they leave a trail. One of the trails is called distiller's dry grains, and we have to look at opportunities there of how we take that material forward and apply it in such a manner that there is a suitable value at the end of the hunt. In doing that, we have a project that we're looking at today taking and moving that product into a more highly flowable material, and so that we can look at additional markets. If you have to sell it in Minnesota only and just maybe across the borders only, then you limit yourself at where this product can go when you're shipping it, say, in rail cars and things of that nature. We talk about pellets. 80,000-pound pellets are not very useful, so we need to do something about that. The value addition of just the commodity crops out there. Edible soybeans, I'm sure that you folks have heard about that. In the edible soybeans, we have projects that are trying to move that forward so that local entrepreneurs and growers within the state of Minnesota can be a part of that chain that may take it all the way to Japan as far as the product is concerned. We're doing continued work in the biodiesel area in trying to identify opportunities across the state, and as if anybody read Governor Polini's comments the other day out of the Department of Ag, there are approximately four different ethanol plants were being considered. We know that we have pledged in the state of Minnesota, up to 58 million gallons of biodiesel to be manufactured within the state. That likely will trigger the mandate. And when that is all said and done, then July 1, 2005 will be an interesting time in which the state of Minnesota again provides its leadership to the nation. The last area that I want to talk just a little about in this general conversation is in the animal products area, whether it be lamb, beef, poultry being chickens or turkeys. We have opportunities, as you're well aware, within the state. And we have the laboratory in AURI and the scientist that is capable of working with entrepreneurs to move these products up in a value-added addition. I draw your attention to the handout that was in your file. And just a couple of things in here I wanted to make some comments about. The biodiesel pre-feasibility study. This was an activity that we carried out last year, finalized it. It is ready to go. It is being used. And so it is a tool, if you will, that can guide us down for individuals who may want to partake and build a biodiesel plant. I want to direct your attention to the soy moor at the bottom. This is a group of 500 farm families that said that, you know, if you look at some of the byproducts that may be in the soybean processing area, and you wind up with a product called lecithin, you have the opportunity then of taking that lecithin and further fractionating it into some 4 to 5 different product entities. Some of these product entities are and have been shown to be effective in slowing down the onset of Alzheimer's disease. The other thing that I would say about these folks, they broke ground in a very cold day in December, and they broke the ground for 2 opportunities. One opportunity is in the area of the lecithin plant that they will put up in Albert Lea, and the other opportunity is biodiesel, than which they will put that opportunity in play early in 05. The last area that I will specifically speak to on this chart is the Bixby Energy System. This project came to us a couple of years ago, several years ago now, in which the individual made a phone call and he said, "Where can I buy corn?" And obviously, we were taken back just a little bit. Why does he want corn? And as we chatted with him, we learned that this individual certainly was not new on the block. He had formed a company called Selective Comfort to Mattress and had done very well there, sold the company, and he was starting another one. His interest was to build stoves, whether they be small or they be large, and to take those stoves and run them off of some grain such as corn. That's why he wanted to know where to get the corn. And we then began to work very closely with him, and the culmination of all that work has been pellets that have been formed that can be utilized in the stove. And I noticed in one of the newspapers, the farm newspapers the other day, the comment that they're looking to build a plant. And that plant is going to be in excess of $15 million. They have looked at, and this was in the newspaper, so I'm just parroting that. They have looked at the area of Redwood Falls, they've looked at Winnebago, and they've looked at Wells. Somewhere out there, this company is beginning to move towards breaking ground and making commitment to build a plant. That's what we're looking for. That's building the plant on the rural countryside, that's using the products that are there and bringing value-added increased margin. At this time,
thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Norris. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Berkman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Kai Bjerknes. I'm Director of Planning and Development at AURI. And I'm going to shift gears a little bit here and jump on a topic that Edgar Olson mentioned at the outset, and that is the Center for Producer-Owned Energy. This is a project that's been underway for some time. In fact, discussions surrounding the center started back in, I think, July of 2002. And the Center for Producer-Owned Energy is a center that was funded by USDA Rural Development through a grant program that was funded in the 2002 Farm Bill. And called for applications that would seek to develop resource centers for producers across the country. And there are about two dozen applications that went into USDA back in the fall of 2003, October. And in the end, they funded about 10 different centers across the country. The competition actually was quite stiff. We were going against Kansas State, Purdue, a group out of Iowa, Montana, Cook College out of New Jersey. Again, in the end, 10 were funded. When it all shakes out, there'll probably be three or four that actually are up and running in the end. So the grant that we sought was for $1 million to fund this center, and the terms of the grant and the requirements for setting this up require a one-to-one match. So it's a $1 million grant, but there's another $1 million of resources that need to go into this activity that the center will undertake. We're currently in the final stages of finalizing our grant application and grant agreement. And we're hopeful that sometime beginning of March we'll have a center, on paper anyway, up and running. Beyond the paper up and running, so to speak, we've actually done a fair amount of preparing in anticipation of getting the center going. So it's moving along quite well. The mission of the center is to support the creation and development of producer-owned value-added businesses. And the focus area, as the name would imply, is renewable energy and related co-product and byproduct production. We have to tell you straight away, and I think that the two to my left would agree, that without a lot of support, the center never would have gotten off the ground. We had a tremendous amount of support. The USDA, both in Washington and at the state level, has been immensely supportive. At the state level, we've had a tremendous amount of support, too, from the Department of Agriculture, Commissioner's Office down, DEED, statewide SBDC offices have lent a hand in a big way here. The universities, including Southwest Minnesota State and the University of Minnesota, among others. Center for Diesel Research, various commodity councils have been enormously supportive as well. So it's really come about through the support of literally over 50 different groups across the state. So we're excited about it and see a lot of potential for agriculture in Minnesota from this project. Just a little bit on how this center is going to be directed. There is a board that's been installed to provide oversight and direction. This was a key component of the USDA's requirements in setting up this center. And it's a producer-driven board. As I said, 7 members, including representatives from 2 statewide farm organizations, Farm Bureau, Farmers Union, representatives from the 4 largest grossing commodity groups, and a representative from the Department of Agriculture. So it's rounded quite well. Again, that group is going to be responsible for setting priorities and direction for the center. The center is going to be housed in Marshall, co-located at the AURI site there. But again, the focus is really statewide. And once again, we're excited that that we can be a part of the center and really help it get off and running. In the proposal, we identified several projects that we considered early on projects that could be implemented literally as soon as the center was finalized by USDA, that after they accepted all of the terms of the agreement and gave us the green light. And I think with a little bit of an overview about some of those projects that we're looking at initially, you'll probably get a better idea of exactly the kinds of things we're going to focus on. Again, it surrounds renewable energy and co-product utilization, developing projects and products emanating from those areas. And now I'll turn it back over to Max Norris, and he'll give you a little bit of a background on some of those projects.
Thank you, Mr. Bergness. Mr. Norris.
Madam Chair, thanks. I probably have the best job in the organization because I get to talk about the projects, I get to be a part of putting them together, and I get to be a part of telling you folks about it. We have about 10 projects that...
Excuse me, Mr. Norris, would you pull the microphone a little closer?
Thank you. We have about 10 projects that that we are working a little bit off the record on at this point, but because the grant is not signed, as Mr. Burton has said. But we need to hit the ground running, and this is what we're trying to do. Of those 10 projects, I'm going to chat just a little bit about four of them, and you'll find it'll be kind of across the board. What we're really looking to do is to deal with renewable energy. It will be biodiesel, it will be ethanol, derivatives thereof, those co-products. It will be very likely some areas in biodigestion, biomass manipulation to for dispatchable power, things of that nature, and power that may just be put up to run local dairies and things of that nature, which I'm sure that you folks, are aware that at least there's one or so in the state. Let me talk just a little bit about the biodiesel generator wind hybrid system. When you begin to look at wind power is wonderful when the wind is blowing. It is less wonderful, I assume, when it is not blowing. So consequently, we're looking at ways perhaps to be able to increase the reliability of the wind and also to create a new market. And that new market would be for biodiesel, a generator set. And we're looking at essentially 100% biodiesel and at maybe one case a 50% biodiesel. We want to keep it as green as we possibly can. We propose to take a look at examining the economic effects that are manifested if you begin to blend these two technologies together. What's it going to cost on a per kilowatt hour? And if indeed we have those numbers, to ask the question, is it affordable in today's economy? Because if it's not affordable in today's economy, we have to move to a second era, third area, and that is to define what do we need to do to add a situation of improvement there. And that well may be, both at the federal and the state level, policy changes, consideration in those areas. We don't know the answer to that yet, so that's, but that's something that this feasibility study will bring forward. And the other aspect that we plan to do is to work directly with a grower group in which I like the word planted. We're going to plant a bunch of these windmills. They're already planted in southwestern Minnesota. And we're going to then put some generators at or near them and carry the study out to get the data. And when the data is in place, then we hope to be able to go forward with it for the next step. We hope we can afford it, but $9 soybeans scares me just a little bit when you look at the price of where oil is right now. But hey, that's life. I've seen soybeans a heck of a lot less than $9 a bushel too. So it's not a matter of when the price will come down; it's the day it'll come down. We don't know when that's going to be, but it will. That's good and bad. So that's project number one. That's trying to take two technologies, hybridize it, and to come out with a benefit for both doing it in the rural part of the state. We're also looking at a technology that will take advantage of ethanol, a material called hydrogen peroxide, and water. And when you blend that together in certain configurations, you create hydrogen. And then we're looking to take that hydrogen to move it forward into running small stationary operations. We've got a plant that is interested in taking a look at this technology, and we hope to be able to take that forward as soon as the grant is in place. Process development and utilization of excess heating capacity. Many of the ethanol plants around the state, the beet plants around the state, the beet sugar plants around the state, are sitting out there with excess heat that at any time T is going off to the atmosphere. We want to take a look at some of these plants that may be in close proximity to one another, the ability of moving them into partnership, if you will, to where that maybe some of the drying costs in some of these, quote, newer ethanol plants that are being discussed at this time, maybe we can take advantage 10 miles down the road to get materials dried. Again, I don't know economically whether that is going to be appropriate or not, but that is the feasibility part of this project. I touched just a bit on DDGs a moment ago, in which I talked a bit about the flowability of these materials and the ability to ship them rather long distances to customers out of the state. We think we know some of the areas that are causing the difficulties during shipment, and the place that we think the problem is, we think that we can pull a product out of it that can be put back in the marketplace and create another market stream for the ethanol plants around the state. This is the last area of presentation that we have, Madam Chair and members. We appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today and stand for questions.
Thank you, gentlemen, very much. As I see you before this committee, I'm glad we're here talking to AURI, first of all, that we've been able to preserve this organization and your work. And I want to personally thank you for what you've done to revitalize AURI after the significant changes that you've had to go through. And I want to congratulate you and others who were involved in obtaining the Ag Innovation Center. I think considering the changes that the organization has gone through, landing on your feet by being able to not only adjust but look forward to this a significant application is a real credit to you folks, and I want to express my appreciation to you and those co-workers who back you up in all your work. I do want to take a moment to ask the Brainerd FFA and any other FFA visitors we have here today to stand. We'd like to welcome you. Glad to have you here today. Mr. Marquardt is your host today, I take it.
Not all.
No, actually, no.
Oh, and Greg Blaine. So the House presented, I left for a moment, I apologize, gentlemen. I left for a moment to present the members of the state FFA organization a House resolution, and we want you students to know how reassuring it is to see young people involved in such an organization preparing to be leaders in rural Minnesota and agriculture. And I want to wish you well, and I know the rest of the committee does too. Thank you, and best wishes. We now have an opportunity for questions of the witnesses. Representative Otto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was listening with interest with your idea of doing a hybridized system between wind and biodiesel. So I just have a question to follow up. Number one, is this the first time this is being done? It sounds like it is, because you want to do a test to see what the... No, okay. Okay, because I was wondering, it sounds like you're setting up a research, you'd like to set up a site where you can research the cost feasibility of it, and I'm also wondering with your siting of these, well, possible sightings, I don't think you've done it yet, you're thinking about it, I believe, if you're going to try to pick areas where there's good wind to start with, and then you're going to see how much you can supplement with wind, or are you trying to figure out how to get some farmers online that might not have the best wind but have some? That's
Madam Chair, Representative Otto, I would think it's probably the latter, but let me go back with some of the other comments that were made. This is not the first time that somebody had the idea of hybridizing the wind with something else. But if you could look out there in the marketplace today or in the industrial place today, you find none of it. It's been of a research nature. It's been a lot. Some of it has come out of the Northeast with some of the activities that are going on there. It has been for smaller operations that would create something, say, for a farm site or maybe to run a dairy. So that's the bottom line is that when it's all said and done, there may be data there that is useful to begin with. The intent, to a great extent, is to, as I said earlier, is to add reliability to wind, whether it be a small site with folks who may not be in a good sited area, or whether you're trying to move energy into the hands of companies like Xcel or whoever the case may be. If you kept up, and I'm sure you have, with Xcel, they get very skittish if you get much, if you even get close to 10%, they start getting very concerned as to whether they can continue to deliver the power. So they have encouraged activities of this nature, and that's one of the reasons that we said we thought it was probably a good project to look into. At least in discussion, they seem to be interested in higher levels of wind.
Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Members of the committee, Madam Chair, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Olson. It's good to have you back. We'll now take up House File 1670, Representative Erdahl's bill. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Before I get into the bill, I'd like to recognize the Howard Lake Waverly Winstead FFA students as well.
Oh. Welcome. Please stand and we'll recognize you.
There aren't any? I tried.
You're on record as having tried.
I did. I knew they were here. I recognized them. Okay, I...
Representative Erdahl, do you want to move your bill?
I move
Representative Erdahl moves that House File 1670 be recommended to pass and refer to the House floor. Your bill is before us.
Yes. All right. We had a moment of confusion there, but we'll move beyond it. Okay, this bill is... 1670, which deals with continuing the program of interest-free loans for methane digesters, a program that expired July 1st, and we'd like to continue that program as a valuable source of renewable energy and a possible expansion of the dairy industry. Just some quick biomass facts. The United States gets approximately 37 billion kilowatt hours of electricity from biomass. That's about 2% of our nation's total, and more than the entire state of Colorado uses annually. There are currently 66,000 jobs in the biomass industry, in biomass energy. Full development of the technology could result in more than 260,000 jobs by 2010. Existing U.S. biomass facilities have the capacity to generate more than 7,000 megawatts of electricity, and biomass is the second most utilized form of renewable energy in the United States, with hydropower ranking first. At this point, let's see, the fiscal note that I have, it says that there is no impact on the state funds. And at this point, I would introduce to you Mr. Mitch Davis of Northern Plains to talk to you about his efforts with the methane digester.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for taking time to listen to what we have to say. I'll give you a little background. I created a PowerPoint mostly for my own benefit.
Sir, would you give your name for the record, please?
It's Mitch Davis, and I'm with Davisco Foods and Northern Plains Dairy.
Welcome.
Thank you. Our company is a third-generation family-owned business. We started in 1943 in southern Minnesota. My grandfather was a butter maker. My four siblings and I are the third generation of the business. Our businesses, just for information's sake, are Davisco Foods, which consists of Le Sueur Cheese Company in Le Sueur, Minnesota, Le Sueur Food Ingredients, separate facility in Le Sueur, Nicollet Food Ingredients in Nicollet, Minnesota, Lake Norden Cheese Company in Lake Norden, South Dakota, Jerome Cheese Company in Jerome, Idaho, and Davis Family Dairies, which is a separate business owned by my siblings and I, for the purposes of milking cows and participating in production livestock, both in South Dakota and Minnesota. In addition, we have a business called Cambria, which is a quartz countertop flooring company, and our family runs all of those entities. Northern Plains Dairy was our first effort in Minnesota to build a new state-of-the-art dairy. I'll just read what our mission is because I think it says it all. To build and operate a state-of-the-art dairy facility, which will be operated in a manner that meets or exceeds existing mandated regulatory requirements, optimizes animal health and comfort, provides opportunity for fulfilling employment, and produces the highest quality products possible. That dairy was started in June of this year on production, but I should tell you the history. We started applying for the permit and the concept in 1998. We spent well over $350,000 in engineering and legal fees as a result of that first effort. We went through three sites and one lawsuit before we finally got the ability and the right to take this risk in a new business. The reasons we wanted to build it is we have a big deficit in milk supply in this state, and it's shrinking every day, and I think many of you are probably familiar with it. Numbers say we lose three dairies a day in this state. We have a substantial investment in our cheese factory in Le Sueur, and we cannot afford to bring raw material from long distances. The second reason is part of the decay of the dairying has been lack of ability or lack of resources to adapt the dairying to the business it has become in other regions of this country and the world. And we wanted to get in, operate our dairy, and set up management systems and financial reporting systems to show and help enhance our producers in their efforts to manage those types of operations. The third reason is our company makes many bioactive products, mostly from the whey proteins of milk, which is the byproduct from cheese. A good example is the total protein that General Mills just came out with last week. The main ingredient in there in terms of protein comes from our cheese plant in Le Sueur. It's a 98% pure whey protein isolate. And you'll see that it's in Walmarts now as of last week, but with the Atkins diet, these types of high-quality sources of protein and sources of bioactive that come from a cow are in great value in the moment and great interest in the research community. There's a picture of the dairy on the, up on the screen. You can get a little idea of the scale. It sits on 102 acres. We farm zero land. All of our feed and our manure goes on someone else's land, and we purchase our feed from our neighbors. The dairy currently has 2,800 animals on site. 2,400, just north of 2,400, are milking today. We have 35 employees. We have about $110,000 a month payroll. We receive approximately $500,000 per month in milk income from the sale of our product milk. And if you accept various economic theories, and one in particular, Dr. Ken Bailey, when he was at Missouri, it's been shown that that $500,000 turns eight times locally. So we create over $4 million of economic activity in our local area in southern Minnesota every month as a result of this dairy. I should tell you that after all that effort and investment, that dairy keeps our cheese plant running a little over an hour a day. It's 7% of the milk we consume in our factory. So we need many, many more of these types of operations in order to fill factories such as ours. We are not about vertically integrating, and it would take 70,000 cows to fill our factory. We have 3,000, and that keeps us plenty busy. So this has to be other dairy farmers in this state doing these types of operations, and I'll get to the digester because it's a key piece, in order to keep this state's factories full of milk and competitive. And I must tell you, if they are not full of milk, they will not be competitive, and that milk has to come from local sources. Why a methane digester? In order to obtain permits, appease protesters, and alleviate numerous regulatory, social, and personal oppositions to the project, Northern Plains incorporated a plug flow anaerobic methane digester into the project to minimize odor in and around the dairy. This was not an economically based decision. I want to emphasize that. We consider it a social environmental tax necessary to realize the economy scales that we wanted to realize in this dairy. That's why the digester was put in. It doesn't flow economically, and I'll explain why and why we think the loan program is essential. Just quickly, a schematic. We start with cow manure, and that's really where milk production and where any value addition to ag cropland starts, is with manure. It's very key. Our manure is gathered constantly by scraping system. It's introduced to a plug flow anaerobic digester, which is a concrete pit of sorts, almost like a coffin. It's long and rectangular. It sits 20 days in there before it's pushed out the other end, and that manure liquid goes to a separator, where the solids are separated and composted. Those are used then to bed the cows in the barn, and the surplus goes on the field for fertilizer. The liquid remaining after separation goes to our basin. It's a 40 million gallon basin, and once per year, that liquid is injected into farmland for nutrients for the crop that we'll buy to feed the cows. It closes the loop, so to speak. The gas produced by bacteria at the proper temperature in the digester is liberated and delivered to a generator, a biogas generator. It's a 3406 Caterpillar engine in our case, and we have two of them. Those generators produce heat on the radiator and exhaust as a result of burning the methane from the cow manure. That heat's used to maintain the digester temp, and the surplus is used for heating other parts of the facility. The electricity from the generator goes preferentially first into the dairy, secondly, to the power company. We supply ourselves in the winter 100% of the electrical needs, basically. In the summer, we supply less than that, somewhere around 75%. So we're a very short-term surplus producer and a small amount, relatively speaking, going back into the grid, which is important when we get to the electrical side of it, the buyback. Just vitals, out of the 2,400 cows milked, 2,800 giving manure, we receive about 45,000 gallons of manure a day into the digester. 160,000 cubic feet of gas are produced from that, and about 6,000 kilowatt hours a day in a 24-hour period are produced. About 260 per hour, which is exactly what we're using at the moment. So we're right now at about 100%. Just some visual for you. Tough to see from the distance, but that's the manure being scraped, and it's being scraped into a flume, which then transports it to this tank underground, which mixes the manure up. It is then presented to these two digesters, which have a tent over them. That tent is being held up by the methane gas. That gas is transported to the generator set you see on the right, And if there's a surplus of gas, which there is momentarily, it's flared. And you can see that on the left. The composting is, you see on the left, a picture of a separator taking the solids from the manure and then the piles for the composting. That goes back in and provides the bedding for the cows. In addition to the digesting, you still have the conventional processes of manure. Here I'm showing the basin last fall being pumped and now injected into the neighboring fields. And I just, that'll take me into the economics of the digester, which is why we think these loans are necessary. Our digester is over $1 million for 3,000 cows. The electricity is used at the dairy primarily. I certainly would have wished that I could sell all the electricity as green power to the very people who came in and were adamantly concerned about the environmental responsibility of this project. I would have thought they would have loved to have the opportunity to purchase this type of power. But statistics show that 80% of the people are for green power, and about 10% are willing to pay a premium for it. So that didn't flow in the marketplace, so we have to use our power, even though we could buy power much more cheaply from the grid. In our area, it's 5.1 cents with our demand, with everything in. We sell it to the grid at 3 cents. And 3 cents a kilowatt hour is all that our power provider will give us. And they have been working 90 days on a buy contract for us. They're very concerned, and it appears to me skittish, about how to word the contract. I don't understand why, but it's very not mature, the electrical industry in this state, for buying green power. The only precedent to this project that I'm aware of is the Havenschild Farm in Princeton, and the difference in our situation and theirs is they had an REA that was very pro-green power, pro-renewable energy, and they receive approximately 9 cents a kilowatt hour, or 3 times what we would receive. We also get 1.5 cents per kilowatt hour in an incentive payment. It comes, the check comes from XL Energy. I applied for it at Department of Commerce. I'm not sure how that's administrated. I just know what happens. I'm not aware, there was some mention in some of the paperwork when I investigated this when we were building the dairy. At the moment, there's no real federal dollars in incentive available as far as I can tell. Operationally, and this is important when you talk about expanding existing dairies and you think about what the existing dairy farmer is used to managing and what his performance responsibilities are every day. We have one full-time agronomist who's got a degree in agronomy from University of Minnesota. He is responsible for the manure from the time it hits the barn floor until it comes back in the form of feed out of the field. And he's also spending 5 to 10 hours a day, depending, on the digester operation and preventive maintenance. The digester could be very dangerous if sparks, cigarettes, etc., are lit and exposed to the gas in the wrong place. And I think we all understand that, but it's very dangerous to be overcome by methane. You've all heard of manure accidents in pits. It's very quick, and you must be educated, and your employees must be educated to avoid that. This digester concentrates all those dangers. Preventive maintenance, oil changes with very expensive oil has to be done quite often, and all this equipment has to be maintained to a T. You also have to have a consistent supply of manure. By consistent, I mean in form of temperature, delivery time or rate, and also percent solids. You can't vary a lot or the digester will be upset. It does not completely eliminate all odors associated with the dairy facility. It's a very important point because in our case, where we're a greenfield facility, there was no livestock on this land before we got there. In existing dairies, such as the Havenschild dairy, where there was livestock and people had a baseline odor to associate to the place, the great improvement is really easy to tell and see when you put in a digester. But when you come into a greenfield site where there's no animals and you put up a barn, you're going to have feed smells. You're going to have barn smells to some extent. you do take away about 98% of the odor-forming compounds in the manure. That's true. So you prevent some of the basic smells, but you don't prevent the odors associated with livestock. You still have all the conventional costs of applying the manure to the land, of the separation, and of disposing. You don't lose any volume in the form of the gas. All you've done is add a unit operation, and you've added expense to the operation. Now, on the subject of the zero-interest loan, the loans are very necessary if we're going to insist upon these types of odor elimination technologies, if our dairy farmers are going to stay competitive nationally and internationally. In our case, I'll tell you what our experience was. It required a personal guarantee, personal income statement of the owner, 200% of collateral value to loan value, so twice as much money as we were borrowing we had to commit and give a first and a UCC filing on to the state. And there's copious amounts of paperwork that I have in the report that you fill out here, including things like feasibility, how it fits into your long-term plan, what kind of cropping rotation, various questions that were already asked and answered when you got your permit. So somewhat redundant, in my opinion, and very copious in terms of paperwork for the average dairy farmer to fill out. It complicates the conventional lending dynamics quite a bit. When you're asking to subdivide certain portions of collateral, such as the generator set or the other equipment associated with the digester, it makes the conventional lender very nervous. Intercreditor agreements have to be done, and he has to cut that out, and they charge you for that. He has to also allow you to send the first security to the state and give it up, and not always are they willing to do that. It didn't, in our case, and again, remember, I can only speak to our case, in over $1 million project, we were allowed $250,000 for which we could get $500,000 in collateral. I did better with a leasing company and with my conventional lender than administering, going to the trouble of the intercreditor agreements and doing all of this upset of the conventional financing just to get the $250,000 at zero interest. It provided, as I said, a very low percentage of the capital necessary and even lower of the total project of the Greenfield Dairy. It doesn't help with operational costs of the digester, and you still have conventional manure costs. That's the application and so on. And it's debatable whether small operations can utilize this technology because of the operational requirements of the farmer and employee type side of things and the economics. And I haven't seen it studied on smaller dairies. I don't know of any report. I only know of the AgStar project at Havenshield, which involved 800 to 1,000 cows. I don't know how this flies on a 400 to 500 cow dairy. It doesn't solve any concerns, the digester itself, of the anti-livestock group. So we shouldn't kid ourselves into thinking that if we insist upon a digester on a new dairy or an expanding dairy, that the protesters go away. They don't. I just had a couple suggestions. I would like to see more capital given to the project and require less collateral and take a different position instead of a first position. I think any dairy that's going to either expand or build new in this state, and I think we need that very badly, would benefit by changing what you give. I think the information should be re-examined and maybe slimmed down as to what's required. Personal guarantees and the first, the 200% collateral, and some of the paperwork. I don't know, there's feasibility questions, and I don't know who at the department is going to see whether this dairy is going to be feasible or not if a bank just gave me a $15 million loan for it. I don't see why I should have a Department of Ag look and see if my $250,000 loan is going to be good. And I think we got to put that in perspective. Also, there was many of the permits and records of the permits and references to the permits asked for by the Department of Ag. And just me being the simple person I am, I wondered why they couldn't walk across the hall and get it from PCA. It's all public record. Why does a farmer have to go grab this and then run it back into them when they should be able to access that electronically? I mean, they know if the dairy's permitted or if it isn't. It's easily found. Conclusion, This assistance is very needed. And if our society is going to insist upon redefining the way we dairy, the way we raise cows in the rural areas versus what we've done historically, and impose new requirements such as digesters to allow for new expectations from these operations, I think the society has to be willing to contribute to the increased cost of these operations, or the operations will be sustained elsewhere in the country and or the world, in which case they will contribute in the form of higher food costs or lost opportunity without having a choice. And I can just give an example. I built an 800-cow dairy in South Dakota last year. I didn't have near the cost nor the requirements, and we've since had 12 dairy operations in the last 18 months start up greenfield in South Dakota. It's going the other way in this state. And I think if we're going to require digesters, we need to be prepared to help support the cost of them, especially with the current electrical buyback situation. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you, Mr. Davis. Representative Otto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm familiar with renewable energy. I've got a wind generator on my property. We have horses and manure and the whole deal. And you said you were only getting a reimbursement of 3 cents, and they're charging you 5.1 cents. Our situation is we get reimbursed the going rate. There are federal laws, purple laws, that should be covering you. And you said you started with 3 cents, and you went up to, but you're getting a 1.5% incentive from Xcel. So I'm just wondering if you're getting good information or somebody might be able to assist you in that, and you're nodding yes, so because that's something that...
Yeah, my understanding is if you're larger than 40 kilowatt or megawatt, you're out of the game.
Okay. Representative Otto.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate that clarification because I'm small, so
yep.
I mean my power.
Yep.
I guess I'm small too. All right, fine. That's fine. Okay, I'm a little person. There's my big friend. Oh, no. He knows that it's a joke, right? He's all right with it. Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. So my other question is, you know, when we look at our generator and the cost of installing and maintaining and all that, we figure out our payout, you know, our payback, you know, when we have the unit paid off and when it's going to cash flow for us. I mean, your added benefit is you are producing your electricity. Costs are going up somewhat, and so you've got to get some buffer from that. But I'm wondering, have you been able to determine a payoff period for your digester?
Over 20 years. The only reason we chose to build it is so we could milk 3,000 cows. I'd be better buying the 5 cent power for many, many, many years.
Thank you. Representative Magnus.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have a question for Mr. Davis here, a couple questions probably. Could you tell me again, what's the cost per kilowatt you estimate?
I can buy my power, everything in it, demand charge, everything, for 5.1 cents a kilowatt hour at our dairy.
But what's it cost to produce it? Madam Chair, sorry. What's your cost of production using the methane digester per kilowatt at the size you use?
Mr. Davis, go through the chair.
I'm sorry, madam.
Proceed.
At the moment, our cost of electrical production is somewhere north of 8 cents. And we have the amortization and debt service incorporated into it, but we've only been running it 60 days. So operational costs on the short term are not real reliable at this moment. I'd like to run farther, longer in time before I say what that is.
Representative Magnus.
Madam Chair and Mr. Davis, I have another question here concerning the manure. I'm not real familiar with dairy cow manure. So... But I would like to know if by going through this process, what's the value to this? Is this deterring the value somewhat of? I assume you've got agreements with the people you're supplying the manure to, and does the process going through this methane digester diminish the value of that manure at all, or enhance it, or how does this factor fit in?
Mr. Davis.
Madam Chair and Representative Magnus, the digester process does not eliminate any inorganic items. They can't be eliminated. Nitrogen doesn't change. It changes its form, and we think it's about 30% more available in the inorganic form as a result of the digestion. All the digestion process does itself is it eliminates pathogens to a great degree, and it eliminates 98% of the odor-forming volatile material in the manure that would go off in the air otherwise at some other place.
Representative Pence.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Davis, thank you. This was very interesting to me. I just want to make a comment. When you talked about the Greenfield situation and your comparison to South Dakota and Minnesota, I come from Northwest Minnesota, and I find when I get down here, the odors are very offensive, and due to cars and stuff. And still I see one person driving a car repeatedly. And so it's a question of what type of odor we want to smell.
Mr. Davis, do you wish to...
Madam Chair and Representative, I agree.
Okay. Representative Otto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate hearing your story, too. I think it's really important. I find it pretty exciting as another energy form, even though it sounds like you've really been on the front lines and gone through it. You understand the mechanics of it. Perhaps we can improve it over time is what I hope. I think your place probably provides a lot of good information and research for people. But you made the comment that your power right now, you think you're generating about 7 cents per kilowatt hour. And I'm wondering if you looked at that over a longer period of time in terms of a long-term investment, if it's going to be free later on once you have it paid off, you know, when you have some operating expenses, your average over a long period of time is going to be a lot cheaper than the power companies can provide for you. Want to comment on that?
Madam Chair and Representative, you're correct, and I should point out, when we're paying those operational costs, we're paying a loan, we're getting to depreciate that equipment. We're not paying the cash to the power company, which is forever gone. So you're correct. To me, it's like owning instead of renting. And so there are advantages that way, and I agree. As we go out longer and get better at this, I hope the economics improve. I think the loan bill is very necessary to help this technology move forward. I just want people to go in with eyes wide open that there are some things to tinker with.
Representative Hyde-Gerken. Oh, excuse me. Representative Erdahl, are you ready to renew your motion and we'll go ahead and act on this proposal?
We have Mr. Marzoff who would also testify.
In the interest of time, if it's all right with you.
All right. Well, that's fine with me. Unless he had something burning that he had to say. He is the tinkerer. Yes, I renew my motion.
Is there any further discussion? Representative Hyde-Gerken.
Yes, I have a question for the next testifier, Mr. Marzo.
There is no next testifier.
Are you prepared to act on this motion? If you're...
Madam Chair.
Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Where's the motion taking this bill to?
This is recommended to pass and be referred to the House floor.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Swenson.
Have you checked with... thank you, Madam Chair. Have you checked with the Ways and Means Committee, Chair? I mean, you're talking about money and changing interest and so forth. I think so. Okay. I just wondering.
Is there any further discussion? Now we'll proceed to vote on the passage of House File 1670. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The motion carries. The motion carries.
Thank you very much.
Representative Anderson, House File 2267.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Anderson. I'll move your bill, House File 2267, that it be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Madam Chair, I have an amendment that I think everybody should have, A1, if I could have that moved.
Representative Anderson, I'll move House Amendment H2267A1.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, if I could just walk through the amendment with you just real quickly tell you a little bit about why we made some changes. I've been working with lenders and the RFA
to come to some agreement on this bill. And the original bill had some percentage changes, and we wanted to go back to what the percentages currently are. We're not going to change the percentages at all, so that's what this amendment would do. And then, Madam Chair, I do have some oral amendments to the amendment about the sums, the amounts of money as we go through this. As we came through this late this morning and into this afternoon, we've been working with the RFA and the lenders to try to tweak this a little bit. And so if you don't mind, if I could walk through those oral amendments.
That would be fine.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The first one is on page 1, line 13. You'd strike $300,000 and insert $350,000.
Does everyone have that page 1, line 13? $350,000. Proceed, Representative.
Thank you. The second change would be on page 2, line 17. Delete $175,000 and insert $200,000. Same page, line 20. Delete $200,000 at the end of the line. Actually, we should probably delete that whole line. I'm sorry. Line 20, the whole line should be deleted. Same page, line 23, strike $175,000 and insert $200,000. Line 26, delete $175,000, insert $200,000. On to page 3. Page 3, line 4. Delete $300,000 and insert $350,000. Line 14, delete $300,000, insert $350,000. And finally, on line 27, delete $300,000, insert $350,000.
All right, does everyone have those changes? All right, proceed, Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, do you want to pass the amendment and then talk to the bill, or how do you want me to do that?
All right. I'll move to adopt the amendment as amended. Any discussion or questions? Now we'll proceed to vote. Those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Members, the Rural Finance Authority has been helping small and beginning farmers in Minnesota since 1986. In that time, different programs have been developed to serve the changing needs of our farmers in Minnesota. These are small and beginning farmers, and over 2,200 of them have been helped through this program since it began. My bill is designed to make this valuable program available to a few more Minnesota producers. We are increasing the amount that the state can lend when it joins with the private lenders in making a loan. The bill also increases slightly the amount of net worth a farmer may have when using this program. Today, that net worth is $274,000, and with this bill, it would increase it to $350,000 net worth. I do have a few witnesses that would like to testify about the RFA program and these changes and how they think they will help. I have David Holmer from AgStar Farm Credit Services. I have Steve Drennan from Farmers and Merchants Bank in Austin, and Wayne Marsloff, the RFA director.
Welcome to the committee, gentlemen.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is David Holmer. I'm the general counsel for AgStar Financial Services, headquartered in Mankato. AgStar is part of the Farm Credit System, which is a federally chartered lending organization. We cover, we serve 53 counties in the state of Minnesota. Farm Credit System, as you, I'm sorry.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Holmer. Oh,
thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate that. The Farm Credit System, as you may know, has a limited scope and mission. The system was created to serve the financial needs of farmer producers, certain businesses, agribusinesses, and rural residents. Because we have such a limited scope and purpose, we have a strong interest in preserving a strong and vibrant farm economy. And for that reason, I'm here just to make a few brief comments in support of Representative Anderson's bill, House File 2267. This is not a case of something that is broken and needs to be fixed. The RFA is working quite well, but it could serve to be built upon. I mean, it has needs for some improvements. Farm Credit Services and AgStar have been participating lenders in the state's Rural Finance Authority programs for many years. We currently have about 100 RFA loans on our books, but we would like to utilize the program more to assist more farmers who are trying to grow. We have not been able to participate to the extent we would like because of the current restrictions in the amount that the RFA can lend or on limits on the net worth that are currently in place. One of our annual Farm Credit Services legislative position statements has been to increase the dollar figures with RFA so that we can utilize the program to a greater extent. And so we're very pleased that Representative Anderson is taking this initiative. Again, I want to repeat that the program isn't broken. It's a very good program. We make use of it, but we would like to see the dollar figures increase so that we could make even more use of it. And we think the changes that have been suggested are reasonable and would work well for us. We think it would make the program available to more of our producers and strengthen the public and private partnership that is at the foundation of the Rural Finance Authority. So with that, I would just say that we do support the amendments as Representative Anderson has outlined, and I'd be happy to respond to any questions that any of you might have.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Gentlemen, as a co-author of the bill, I just like to congratulate you for working on this and bringing it forward. One of the things that we tried to accomplish last summer and through some of the other bills that I have also is through increasing the access of capital. And I think this is an important step for farmers to utilize this, and I certainly hope that increasing the loan limits here through RFA will reach that goal, because I think that there maybe was some underutilization because they weren't finding that it was as beneficial to them as it could be, and I hope that this helps them realize their goal. Thank you.
Mr. Drennan, welcome to the committee. Would you state your name for the record?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Steve Drennan, President, First Farmers and Merchants State Bank, Austin, Brownsdale, Sargent, Minnesota, three banks.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Drennan.
Thank you. We are not near as large of organization as my colleague here, Dave, at AgStar, but we do also use the Rural Finance Authority and have found that, as Dave has said, that there is a need to modify the program a little bit. He had said that the program was not broken, and it is not broken. We have used it in conjunction with FSA in order to make it work in some cases. By increasing these limits, hopefully we will not have to do that anymore. I think it's an excellent program for the young beginning farmers and for possible restructured situations. The program is very easy to use, user-friendly for my people that put these loans together. We also decided we did not want to increase the percentage because we feel we have the responsibility of the loan. We do not want the state to have that responsibility. It's still up to us to make good, solid loans, and we want to keep it at that level. That's about all I have to say, and once again, if you have any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them.
Any questions for Mr. Drennan? Representative Heidgerman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is probably going to be to Mr. Representative Anderson. I'm not really sure if I understand the full intent of this legislation. Is it just a beginning farm program that you're addressing, bringing up the caps, or are you also looking at the livestock expansion program? I think there's three programs that we have, and they're all tied up in different interest rates.
Representative Anderson.
You know, or just the way I see it is a beginning farm, which would be good, too. It's a very good start. But.
Representative Heidgerman, maybe if Mr. Marsloff would come and give his testimony, he might be able to answer your question in the midst of his testimony. I'll have him come and give his testimony first.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Marsloff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Wayne Marsloff, the Interim Director of the Ag Finance Division of the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. The primary activity within the Ag Finance Division is the Rural Finance Authority. Madam Chair and Representative Heideck, I'm sorry, I have blown your name every time I've been up here. Could I just say Representative?
Representative Buck.
Thank you, sir. We've been working on this bill for the. We've gotten some feedback for several years as far as some of the loan limits and that sort of a thing are concerned. There is some differences in the interest rates, and part of the reason for that is that we only have a limited amount of access to what is called tax-exempt general obligation bonds. And each major bond sale that goes out, we have access to $4.5 million of tax exempt. That's the lowest rate of interest that we can provide. So over a two-year period, there's about three major bond sales. So over that two-year period, we have access to $13.5 million of tax exempt. Now, most of you have seen our reports before, and you know that we put out more loan participations than that. The balance is taxable bonds, and those are sold separately and sold a week right after the big bond sale. So we have a specific bond sale for the Rural Finance Authority to provide taxable bond proceeds to provide us with the rest of the funding that we need. Because the basic and the seller-sponsored loan programs are the two primaries, and the legislature has included that they are to be the primaries, they are the first ones to receive the access to the tax exempt. So consequently, you will see at the present time our interest rate on the tax on the basic and the seller-sponsored is 4%. On the other end of the priority list are the restructure and the livestock expansion program. They are fully supported by taxable bonds, and so at the present time, our interest rate on those is 6%. We have a blended rate on the ag improvement because we're trying to give them a little bit of a benefit. So we've got a blended on the ag improvement program, and that's at 5%. We're using half and half. So that's why there are the different interest rates.
Any questions for Mr. Marsloff? Oh, pardon me, Representative Swenson is next, and then Hammer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Marsloff. I think the question I have is, these limits, do they apply to all three programs? I mean, is each program, the limits we're talking about in here as to the maximum amount of available to a lender, I mean to a producer, I mean, does that dollar limit apply to each program or to all three programs, or?
Mr. Marzo.
Madam Chair and Representative Swenson, need to go, like, for instance, to the second page, wherever you see the 200,000 there as far as the limitation. The 200,000 is for the basic, for the seller-sponsored, and for the ag improvement. The 275 at line 29, where it was to delete the 375, that 275 is for, I've got to track them here now, that's, I thought I had that, but that one is for the livestock expansion. The restructure one stays where it's at.
So the different, Madam
Representative.
So the different programs have different figures then?
Madam Chair and Representative Swenson, yes, they do. The primary ones, again, are the basic, the seller-sponsored, and the ag improvement. We try to keep those, the parameters on them, the same, because that's the same focal group. The livestock expansion is on the other end of the continuum as far as the size of operations and the size of the loan. The restructure kind of falls in between. So there are differences. There's differences in net worth. There's differences in the total amount of loan participation.
Thank you.
Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know we're short on time. I hope this is quick. I'm interested in the changes. Lower the percentage back down to the originals, raise the caps. Can you? I'm on the bill also, and I still support it, but I'm curious as to your thinking on that, if you could, quickly.
Madam Chair, I'll take that one because we're quite adamant, quite frankly, as far as the 45% participation is concerned. The original bill that came out had that changed to 67%. With the lenders only holding 33% of it. There has been some inching up over the years. It started out at 25% participation, went to 35, and finally at the 45. We want to provide as much of an assistance we can to those young farmers, and yet we want to make sure that the lender has a majority ownership in the loan. And very frankly, we've had a very good working relationship with the lenders. They've been the quality of the loans that have been coming in have been quite good. Our concern is that if we go from the 45% to the 67%, the quality of the loan is going to go down. Nothing taken away from Steve and the other folks, because they're taking a whole lot less risk. Plus the fact that within our master participation agreement, the loan servicing is the responsibility of the lender that submitted the loan. If you're dealing with 10 loans and you've got full exposure on 5 of them and only a third of the exposure on 3, guess which 3 get worked on last. So we want to make sure that we continue this relationship where the lender has a majority interest and consequently will continue a majority interest in servicing and property. And I think that's...
Any other questions? Any further discussion? The chair removes her motion that House File 2267, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Any discussion? We'll proceed to vote. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, the motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
Thank you, gentlemen. This meeting is adjourned.